We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington.
We interrupt our program to bring you a special broadcast. The German news agency...
We interrupt this program to bring you a news bulletin from Washington. The White House has just announced...
Here is a news bulletin. Shots have reportedly been fired.
Here's another late development, and this news keeps coming in.
This is an NBC News hotline report.
Special report. Verdict sparks violence. National earthquake.
Secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Can your heart stand the shocking facts of the true story of Joshua P. Warren?
Of the sky and to high strangers around the globe. This is Speaking of Strange with Joshua P. Warren.
And the world is becoming more and more insane every day. Welcome to the program that gives you breaking news and insight regarding the paranormal and downright weird, where the unusual becomes usual, and we don't just discuss it. We go in the field to investigate. Let us begin tonight in the great state of Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska. The police there say a man crashed his car through the front door of a pizzeria called Valentino's. Crashed right through, glass, chairs, tables flying all over the place. He rolled down his window and ordered a pizza. I'm serious. I'm not making this up. They say the guy seemed totally alert and good nature. They took him to the hospital. There were no injuries. And so now the cops are trying to figure out how to sort this one out. Hey, thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, author of books like Haunted Asheville, How to Hunt Ghosts, and The Secret Wisdom of Kukulcan. I'm founder and president of Lemur Paranormal Investigations. My producer and engineer is Mr. Hardwood Forrest Connor. Good evening, Forrest.
Good evening, Joshua. Now, I mean, if you know you really screwed up and you've just crashed through a pizzeria, it's like, have a sense of humor and, hey, I'm already screwed up. Let me just order a pizza real quick.
See, the thing is, this story from the Omaha newspaper there does not make it clear if it was a case of that or the guy just sort of
not
perceiving the gravity of the situation. So we'll figure that out. I'd like to know what kind of pizza was that amazing that he was that excited about. What, you know, was it meat lovers?
Extra anchovy?
Yeah. What was the most exciting pizza on the menu? And also, it's possible when that happens, it could end up being your last real meal for a while.
True.
I know you're a pizza person, aren't you, Investigator Shelley Wright of Wright's Coin Shop?
I love pizza.
Now, what is your favorite type of pizza?
Oh, I have many different types. It just depends on my mood. Mm-hmm. But usually it involves something with some pepperoni. Mm-hmm. Ooh, and I like feta cheese, and I could just rattle on and on and on. Pizza is fabulous.
Yeah, I'm a pizza guy as well. Of course, you know, you hear me talk about how creative I've gotten over the past few years trying to make healthy pizzas, and it can be done.
Right.
It takes a lot of work,
It's a lot easier to make a big, juicy, fat, greasy, unhealthy pizza.
I would rather order a great, big, juicy, unhealthy pizza.
Yeah. So, do you ever make your own pizzas?
No. I probably should. I used to a long time ago, but it's just so much easier to go and chat with my friends while they make the pizza for me.
But the homemade pizzas are so good. I used to work at right when I got out of college at a local pizza place here, so I learned how to toss dough and and make the dough and all that good stuff. So.
Yum.
You know, it's a running theme here when you look at the chat room to people who are listening to this program live. I don't know if they're all high or what, but they say this show always makes them ravenously hungry.
Oh, yeah.
Every time they listen to Speaking of Strange, I mean, it gets to a point where they can't stand it. They have to stop and say, I'll be right back. You know, I'm going to go get some food. And
high strangers around the globe.
High strangers everywhere. So I don't think we're helping them stay satisfied tonight. I think everybody's hungry already. They're all going to go eat pizza now.
Everybody's got to have some pizza.
I want pizza now.
Before we actually got started, I was thinking, ooh, I could go for some pizza.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
I've got some durian. Will that tide you over?
Ew, no. Yeah, on a pizza.
That's an interesting pizza topping.
No, boy. It wouldn't. Like putting rotten eggs on there.
That would be interesting.
Interesting.
Well, we have got quite a show tonight. Here we are. It's winter time. It's been all snowy and cold and dreary. We are going to sort of escape all that a little bit. Mentally, anyway, because, last year when I was traveling around doing the Paranormal Paparazzi TV program, we shot a lot of different segments in really nice places, warm places, Florida, Texas, Louisiana. And one of the stories that we shot I found very interesting, but unfortunately it didn't make the cut on the TV show. And I don't think that I was ever able to really follow up and talk about this segment because I had to be careful about talking about things that I'd shot, right? Even though I had mentioned this subject prior to me getting involved with that TV show. What I'm trying to say here is at one point, C. Eric Scott and I went to the mountains of North Georgia and we investigated some of these ruins that some people have claimed were left behind by the Mayans. This sort of controversial underground archaeological hypothesis that the Mayans visited North America and set up some encampments around Florida and Georgia and even western North Carolina. So we went there, we visited these ruins, and we talked to the leading expert behind this, one of the big proponents. We shot a segment about it, but since we shot that segment, which again did not air, there has been an enormous new surge of research done regarding this issue. And recently there was a program that I saw on the History Channel's H2 channel called America Unearthed. Have you seen this show yet, Forrest?
I have.
Have you seen the episode about the Mayans coming to the U.S.?
It is. Is it the one where the guy is coming out of the national park and he's talking about...
They won't let him in.
Right.
They didn't even let him in. And we got to go there and walk around. So something dramatic has changed just since we were there. Because we were there in the early part of 2012. Well, tonight, during hour two of the show, I'm going to go over this big, long list of evidence that's now been discovered for the fact that the Maya did make it here, but here's where we get a really weird twist thrown in. On top of what I saw myself when I went down there, on top of what was presented in this History Channel program, I now have a new, even crazier, more twisted theory that ties the Mayans in to aliens and Judicolor Rock. Brand new theory. How does that sound?
Cool.
You guys have both been to Judicolor Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Once or twice.
In fact, Shelley, you went there when you were taking your classes.
Yes.
To become a paranormal investigator. Forrest, you have participated in our big expedition there to look into the caves.
Right.
Up above. And maybe that's something else we'll touch on in hour number two. But if for those of you who are into this kind of real underground Indiana Jones kind of mystical occult archaeology, you're going to like hour number two of the program tonight. And especially, you know, with that more local twist, if you know what Judicolor Rock is. It's actually a good time to go out and look at these kinds of sites because the vegetation's down, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's a real pain when you go out there and it's in the middle of summer and you're fighting growth and weeds and snakes.
Mosquitoes, gnats.
Yeah. And that's another reason that this time of year, when it's often a little too cold for people to go out and comfortably take our ghost tours, we arrange ghost hunts at indoor locations. And there's a brand new page up right now at hauntedasheville.com. And it says, winter specials, you know, ghost hunts. And you click that page, and it's got three different locations there that you can choose from to take ghost hunts. Now, each location has its own odd little schedule, so we have to try to work with you in coordinating the place. One, of course, is the Asheville Masonic Temple. The other is the Grove House. And the other is the house on Chicken Hill, which looks like the house out of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And also, a freaky photo was taken there years ago of what looks like some kind of little creature. You've seen this photo, Shelley.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. So, but we're only offering all these ghost hunts for the time being for winter. So it's the perfect time to take advantage. Go to hauntedasheville.com and look at the ghost hunts we have for the winter. And you'll also find a link there to speakingofstrange.com. And, well, you know how that goes. We keep everything stored there. So, now you haven't been to the Chicken Hill House yet, Shelley.
Not yet.
It's kind of an unpleasant place.
But that's good.
I don't know. Is it?
Yes, yes. You don't want it all nice and happy and friendly and all that. You want it to be creepy and uncomfortable and like you just don't know what's around the corner.
A guy got shoved down the stairs there.
Well, one of my friends got shoved down the stairs for our event.
Yeah, so, okay, it's spooky. You know, we have a lot of haunted places around here. Some people think it's because that this area was considered so sacred by the Native Americans in general. And this kind of connects to what I am going to talk about in hour number two. The expert that we interviewed in Georgia is a man named Richard Thornton, and he said that in western North Carolina, it's a mistake for us to think that the Cherokee Indians were the dominant tribe around here. And he has a whole different way of describing what the Native American landscape looked like around western North Carolina. In fact, we'll take a break. When we come back, I'll explain that to you. It's very interesting. And also, we're going to come back in with some great bumper music. I want you to keep in mind that it's a theremin being played in the bumper that we're going to come back with. Now, the theremin, again, the only instrument in the world that is played without physical contact. You kind of wave your hands around it. And I'm going to give you a good example of what this strange instrument can do. It's the program where the unusual becomes usual. We dig into the amazing, the remarkable, the extraordinary, the downright weird. It's called Speaking of Strange. I'm Joshua P. Warren, and we'll be back right after this.
Thank you.
again, this is the theremin you're hearing. It's being performed by Peter Pringle. It's called The Inner Light. And he's playing one of these big old 1920s wooden box theremins. Has a very Irish Celtic sound. And believe it or not, I think this piece is from Star Trek, The Next Generation. Yeah. So you see, you know, it's a good example of how the theremin can produce some very, beautiful, poetic strings type sounds. You know, guys, I did the theremin concert there at 13th Night about 2 weeks ago. I've been practicing every single day, and I am twice as good as I was 2 weeks ago. It's amazing how much better, because what happens is you're waving your arm back and forth like this, and you got to build up some muscles in here. You should see my arm now, Forrest. It's incredible, ladies. Yeah, you see what you can do with that move?
Been using that shake weight, haven't you?
I ought to start carrying a shake weight around when I'm not playing the theremin. Same thing. But I bought a little mixing board, and I bought a little amp, and I mean, I've got just the Mac Daddy little setup now. It looks very sleek. It's cool. I could put it in my my old doctor's bag and carry it around. So I think I'm ready to start entertaining some offers. If anybody out there is interested in having me entertain them at a party, at a restaurant, at a special gathering, because I consider it a stress reliever, which is weird, but think about it. If you're sitting there and you're playing something like you just heard, all the focus of your mind is on the note. So that takes away all the other distractions in your life, and that I think that's what a stress reliever is, right? Something that you just focus everything on, and it takes away that kind of broad, dull sense of, oh, there's too much crap to deal with in the world, right? So, If you want to try out my skills on the theremin at your gathering, email me. Go to joshuapwarren.com, and I will look at what you're offering. joshuapwarren.com. So listen, before the break, I was mentioning that if you live in Western North Carolina, you always hear about the Cherokee Indians. They are the big tribe, the eastern band of the Cherokee. They've got the casino. And when you study the history of Asheville, one thing you frequently hear is that Asheville was built here because this is where some old Cherokee trails crisscrossed. Well, this guy, Richard Thornton, he said that, surprisingly, there were no Cherokee establishments in the area that is now downtown Asheville, that their boundary was about 40 miles to the west of that at that time, and that most of the Native Americans around here were Shawnee and Creek. And he wrote something here, which I'm going to read verbatim. He says, "The early maps of North Carolina show no Cherokees in the western North Carolina mountains, only Creeks and Shawnee. The French Broad and Swannanoa valleys were Shawnee territory, as was the area around Saluda. The word Swannanoa comes from the Creek words Suwanee-Owa, which means Shawnee water. The Hendersonville area southward was Creek until 1763, when all the Indian tribes were pushed out of the mountains from Murphy eastward." I was mistaken with what I said about the direction. He says the current Cherokee reservation is 45 miles east of their eastern line in 1763. I said west, it's east. Prior to 1763, the area around the reservation was occupied by the Oconee Creeks. Oconaluftee means separated Oconee people in the Creek language. The word has no meaning in Cherokee. So much of what the Cherokees currently tell tourists are fairy tales. The Oconee's big five-sided mound in Birdtown on the Oconaluftee River was leveled to build a sewage treatment plant in the 1980s, so tourists wouldn't ask questions about a five-sided creek mound being on a Cherokee reservation. So, that's pretty compelling, don't you think?
Very.
I mean, and if this is all accurate, and he's, I mean, everything I know about Richard Thornton is academic, and this is a, he's a very thorough researcher, okay?
Well, that sort of backs up, my fiance Kelly's been doing research into her family history, and
yeah?
She's always been told she is from the area, but she found Creek Indian.
Oh.
In her, like, there's some Cherokee in there too, but there's Creek Indian in there also.
Well, that would explain it, and especially if you look at this word origin stuff, Suwannee Oa means Shawnee water, and that's where Swannanoa would come from. I've always thought Swannanoa was a weird word, you know. But yeah, so that's very cool, and I really think it's never too late to go back and revise history. And I know some people get insulted by these discussions. It's like, I think of it like the people who live in Egypt right now. They become insulted if someone implies that the ancient Egyptians were not the same people as the modern-day Egyptians. And yet, frankly, when you look at the depictions of the ancient Egyptians, they look a little different than the modern Egyptians do. And the reason the modern Egyptians get offended by this is because they want to take the credit for all of the achievements of the ancient Egyptians, right? But the odd thing is, it's not really insulting them. They obviously originated from those people in some way, but that's the perception of the indigenous folks. And I think when it comes to Native Americans, it's often the same thing. The Native Americans are, of course, so proud of their heritage that any attempt that seems at least some perceived attempt to maybe rearrange that a little bit becomes a hotbed of controversy. But there's no reason that we should think that history was laid out with all these nice, distinct boundaries and lines and territories. And I mean, history doesn't work that way. Humans kind of merge into each other as a bunch of cloudy masses that kind of intermingle, and it's a very sloppy, organic kind of affair. And when we get into this whole Mayan situation with them coming to America, you'll see, I think, how relevant that is. And it's funny to me how that some people become so involved with these ideas of ancient mysticism. Some people do absolutely crazy things. Flagstaff, Arizona, here, had a situation recently. A guy, he was a 28-year-old man, jumped into a meteor crater. All right. Somebody saw this guy jump into the meteor crater, and he fell more than 100 feet and lived. And it says that, you know, the guy was all busted up. You know, they said that he had dislocated and broken his right arm, broken his leg, had severe pain in his legs, was losing consciousness. They rescued him. And when he finally was able to speak and explain himself, they said, "Why did you jump into the crater?" And he said, "To appease the gods." Because apparently this guy says or believes that there was a history of sacrifices being given to this meteor by natives. And he, I don't know why exactly, but for now, he was trying to be the latest sacrifice to appease the gods.
Well, so he didn't actually appease the gods because he didn't die.
He's got to go back now.
He's got to go back.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
For rescuing him. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I have another crazy story for you. Plus, an update for you regarding Dr. Bill Forshton. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's Speaking of Strange.
Stretch to the point of no turn.
Stuff all around the world, and it's going to get even odder next hour. I promise you that. But I've got some news here to report on the last Speaking of Strange. I revealed the new Sunshine Simple Nonprofit Foundation that I am in the process of creating. It is to deliver solar generators and other independent energy sources and technologies to people in times of crisis and need, and help to power medical equipment and pumps, charge cell phones, maintain refrigeration, sterilization and cooking devices, computers and modems, safe lighting, etc. And not only in disaster times, but the rest of the year, you know, helping people get their hands on this kind of technology. Well, to get the nonprofit set up takes $6,000. So we're in the process of raising the money to set up the nonprofit. And last week on the program, I announced that I have a copy of Dr. William R. Forstchen's New York Times best-selling novel, One Second After. It's hardback. And Bill Forstchen actually signed this book right in front of me at 13th Night. It says, Best Wishes, William R. Forstchen, right there on the interior title page. And I said that we would auction this off to the highest bidder, and every penny would go to the Sunshine Simple Charity Foundation set up. And I would like to announce that the winner of the auction is a lady named Judy. I do not want to give out to her last name on the air without specific permission, but Judy is going to receive this book and a copy of one of my books signed for $72.50. So that means that over the past week, we have now, with Judy's contribution, raised over $300 toward the Sunshine Simple Nonprofit Foundation set up.
Good job.
We're on our way to the $6,000. And so thank all of you so much who are contributing to the foundation. It means a lot, and I think it's great karma. I think it's good for everybody. And the only way that that your world and our world is going to improve, I think, is one good deed at a time. That's why it's kind of funny, because it's easy to live in this country and have this kind of like very self-serving attitude. But the bottom line is, if the world that you live in sucks, then it's going to suck for you too. So the more you can take what you can do to help out the rest of the world, then the better you're going to be helped out as well. And especially since none of us are getting any younger. We're just getting older and more vulnerable. And we're gonna need that world to be as kind as possible to us when we're old, right, guys?
Exactly.
We were talking about that earlier. So you better start making a lot of friends right now. So thank you, Judy. We will get that arranged. And any other ideas that anybody has to continue bringing in some money to get this set up, please share it with me. And go to sunshinesimple.com to watch the video there and learn more about the foundation. You know, I believe so much in karma because it makes sense to me scientifically that for every action there's an opposite but equal reaction. And sometimes you see a story that just seems to prove it. And here's one from Memphis, Tennessee. Apparently, a guy there killed his sister. He stabbed her several times in the mobile home they shared. He put her body in his truck and drove to a remote area to dump the body. His truck got stuck, so he got out to walk to a nearby home to make a phone call. This guy's having a bad day, right? Not as bad as his sister had.
Oh, yeah.
So he's all stressed out, obviously. He gets out of the truck. He starts to walk to get help. Boom, heart attack hits. And he drops dead. So it took the cops just a little bit, you know, to piece this together. Because, I mean, think how weird this is. Somebody discovers on this remote Tennessee road a dead man laying there in the middle of the road. Nearby is his truck. Okay? The truck appears to be stuck. Simple enough. But then you see he has a bundle in the back. And somebody had to open that bundle and gasp that there's a murdered woman. She probably looked pretty gruesome, all stabbed up.
Mm.
So they're presuming, well, okay, this is his truck. I guess that was easy enough to prove. He's got his dead sister in the back. They go to the mobile home. That's when all the forensics kicks in. And they say, wow, the guy killed his sister and then was struck dead with a heart attack. Maybe his sister's ghost killed him.
Perhaps.
You think that can happen?
Yeah, I think that can happen.
I tell you what, you know, you going to say something?
I was going to say, have you ever seen Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil?
Yeah, I love that movie.
Mm-hmm.
When I was doing the Morganton Ghost Walk, which last October, I was hired by the city of Morganton to create the first ever walking tour in the city of Morganton called the Morganton Ghost Walk. And after I researched all this and wrote it, then I had to go there and perform this and train guides who work for the city of Morganton to do the tour. And you came along for that sample tour, Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
You may recall one of the stories that I dug up about the Morganton area, which may or may not be true. It's a legend, you know, who knows. Was that, and I'm trying to remember how this went, but I think sometime in the 1840s, there were a couple of brothers who lived together in a little cabin on a hill near Morganton. And their job that was to go out and shear herds of sheep. They were sheep shearers. I guess there were a lot of herders back then. So, and their names, what was the name? A weird name. Asa something. I can't even remember now. It's been, you know, I've learned too much since then, but I've got it, you know, I've got the info written down. Well, anyway, the brothers go out into the woods to shear some sheep. And they come back into town on a wagon, and one of the brothers is dead because, apparently he had fallen on his sheep shears. So he had a pair of shears run through his midsection. So everybody, of course, thought this was horrible. Obviously, there were people who thought, I wonder if he could have killed his brother. But who's to say? There were no witnesses, so should be the end of story.
Case closed.
Yeah, they buried him. We'll give this guy the benefit of the doubt. Let's move on. Well, it turns out there was another guy in town who claimed eventually that he had been in a bar or a shop or something at one point and saw those two brothers fighting. And the one brother who survived had said something really mean and threatening to the other brother. So this guy, he believed that that brother killed the other brother, right? You keeping up with this so far without me using names? So the guy who believed the brother was a murderer, he decided to use an old technique from the old world. He dug up the dead brother's body after it had been in the ground for a while. And he pulled off basically the skull. And one night he snuck into the living brother's house. And he hid the skull of the dead brother in the attic right above the mantle. And just left it there. Well, a month goes by. 2 months go by, and everybody in town realizes they hadn't seen this brother. So they open the door, finally, they barge in, and here is the brother, the murderous brother, we'll say, and now he's dead. He's sitting in a chair, shrunken, withered, ghastly, and it looked as if he had starved to death. And they believed that that spirit of the dead brother exacted his vengeance, and he couldn't do a lot, but one thing he could do was hold that brother inside, not allow him to leave that house until he starved him to death. And that was one of the techniques that was used to exact the vengeance in the old days, when they believed that somebody might be getting away with murder, but it couldn't be proven. It was thought that the skull of the victim would work it all out in the end. We're going to take a break. When we come back, maybe you've heard this story about the plan in Florida to deal with all the pythons. This might be something you and I could get involved with, Forrest. It seems like one of our adventure schemes. and then I've got another story here about another creature in Florida. May as well dig into some Florida stories, because we're going to be talking a lot about Florida and Georgia. Well, probably the whole rest of the show, as it turns out, tonight. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's the program where the unusual becomes usual. It's called Speaking of Strange.
You hardly ever saw Granddaddy down here. They only come a town about twice.
final minutes of hour number one on tonight's Speaking of Strange. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren. And next hour, you're going to love it if you're of the Indiana Jones archaeological conspiracy type. We're going to give you a very, very complete picture of the evidence for the Mayans coming to America, and this is based upon the, I guess you could call it synchronicity, that I myself got to go and investigate some of the so-called Mayan ruins in Georgia, even before this new History Channel show came out about the topic. And for years, my team and I have been looking at Judicata Rock in western North Carolina and trying to figure out what it's all about. And I think it all ties together in sort of a new, crazy, grand conspiracy. And it's not completely fleshed out, but maybe I'll flesh it out here on the air. We'll do this stream of consciousness. We'll just go through this process together.
Let's do it.
But, you know, I've been to Miami a few times. I know you have, Forrest, right?
Once or twice.
Well, the media down there is buzzing about this plan to deal with all of the huge pythons that are just taking over the Everglades. I mean, just, you know, apparently just thousands of them. And some of these pythons are, they're claiming it maybe 18 feet long. So there has been, you know, a lot of people have wondered, how do you deal with this? In fact, the last time I was in Florida, which was last August, I think, I was going to eat some python at a restaurant. They were serving python, but they were sold out. So many people were eating pythons down there. And mind you, eating a python is not something that I ever wanted to do in my life, but I figured, with the way things are going this year, I may as well add it to my resume, right? Of all the nasty things I've eaten. It's never too late to get started, though. So here's their plan right now. And this is especially of interest to any of you out there who are maybe down on your luck, and you're looking for a way to pass the winter, a good excuse to go to Florida. I mean, I'm about ready to jump in the car and do this. There is a contest from January 12th through February 10th. It's a contest to see who can kill the most pythons. And you pay a $25 fee, and you take an online training course. They say already 400 people have signed up. Then you go down to the Everglades, and they say that when you kill the pythons, you have to do them according to a humane method, which means either, according to the Fish and Wildlife, you can shoot it in the head with a, quote, firearm of a safe but effective caliber, end quote, or you are permitted to whack off the python's head with a machete, provided you do so in an ethical manner. The commission says, quote, make sure your technique results in immediate loss of consciousness and destruction of the Burmese python's brain, end quote. So you're just out there in the jungle on...
whacking off python's...
Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly what you're doing. Have you ever done that before?
I've never whacked off a python.
Shelley? Okay. Basically,
no.
You get a prize, they say. If whoever kills the most pythons gets a $1,500 prize. And they say whoever kills the longest python gets a $1,000 prize. So if you kill the most and the longest, you can get $2,500 off of a $25 bet.
Bad. Not bad at all.
No. Would you shoot them or whack their heads off?
I'd whack their heads off.
I think I would, too.
Actually, I'd try both just to see if whacking their heads off it works. And then
I've whacked a snake's head off before with a machete.
Actually, you did it in your own house, did you not?
I did, yeah. Well, pretty close by. And you see, and I'm not proud of that, but sometimes it has to be done. And, you know, the thing is, if you're shooting a snake close up, that seems like that could be dangerous. Like the bullet could ricochet
right,
and hit you or your buddy or something. But if you cut the head off, you know what you're doing.
There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. So, oh, well, okay. I do have another Florida story. Oh, I forgot to hit my Florida bell. Yeah. But we're going to have to take a break, so we'll catch up to this one later on. There's a lot of Florida stuff to talk about. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's the program where the unusual becomes usual. It's called Speaking of Strange, and we are going to kick off hour number two after these important messages.